So thanks for the chance to talk about my research. I'm going to talk about a very different kind of area today, talking about the practices, the social and sexual attitudes and the forms of regulation that led to what we have today, a crisis, in a sense, about the experiences of child sexual abuse across the 20th century. I'm actually going to pick up on some quite similar themes to Sarah's presentation, thinking about the sort of quotidian experiences of inequality and also thinking about issues of intersectionality. But like Simon, I'll also be pointing to the importance of institutions and the significance of regulation. So the project I'm going to be talking about is a project that was based on a corpus of newspaper reports on the history of child sexual abuse, and it was looking at the styles of reporting and the forms of languages that were used to talk about what we would now label historical child sexual abuse. And we turn to newspapers because clearly there's no other very easily accessible archival source in looking at this this problem. And that was supplemented by looking at practitioner norms and cultures, with a particular emphasis on social work, on education, and on policing, to chart the changes over time in languages training and best practice in relation to safeguarding. Now, the provincial and the local press turned out to be a very interesting and quite underused source in relation to this topic, because there were quite high levels of reporting of child sexual abuse cases, both locally and reporting on national cases. We get very interesting detail in those reports, including a bit of background on the perpetrator, description of the circumstances of the alleged offence, and perhaps most interesting, very frequently there's judicial comments on the sentencing or dismissing of the cases. We ended up with a sample of around 700 cases. Clearly, we're making no claims to capture anything like the full range of cases across this period, 1918 to 1990, partly because of the euphemism used in reporting. It's quite difficult to search and to know which words to search under, but also because there's no set legal category that is used to prosecute those kinds of offences. Instead, there's a range of possible avenues of prosecution, most of which are not age-dependent, most of which are cases that can also be used for sexual assaults between adults. Now, to turn to the question of inequalities and how we see this interacting with our sample data set, of course, the primary inequality that emerges is that of age. By definition, these are offences where adults are abusing their ability to manipulate and influence children. And their ability to offend often rested on the simple inequality built into the legal system that children's testimony until the 1990s needed some kind of corroboration by an adult witness. That, of course, is not available for the majority of these cases. So age is the kind of predominant axis of inequality that's important to our work. But we also see strong patterning of inequalities of social power and authority in relation to gender. The offenders in our sample, and of course as found by other more contemporary research, are in the vast majority of cases male. The child victims and survivors of abuse are more evenly divided between girls and boys, although there's still a predominance of girls amongst the documented cases. Nonetheless, there's strong evidence that boys were less likely to disclose or recognise sexual abuse, and that larger numbers of boys experienced abuse than the data set suggests. That's one of the first, I think, interesting sort of counterintuitive conclusions of our research. While girls and women in some socioeconomic respects are more likely to be experiencing forms of inequality and in that sense are more vulnerable to abuse on the dimensions of physical and emotional abuse, in relation to sexual abuse, social norms made and of course still make it much harder for boys to recognise and acknowledge abuse. We also see hierarchies of social class and inequalities of socioeconomic status in this work. the ability of predominantly male abusers to exploit their educated or professional status allowed abuse to flourish in those settings where professionals came into contact with children, in schools, in religious institutions, and amongst looked after children. And you can see there in our data set that teachers emerge as by far the largest category who are accused of abuse, but clergy and doctors are also quite well represented. So those professionals who regularly come into contact with children are by far overrepresented given their distribution in the actual population. So the ability of educated men to use their standing in the community as a credible defence meant that they developed amongst these groups for these abusers a sense of a degree of impunity. And you can see, this works, you can see here that again in our data set the most common by far category of abuser there is authority figure. Now, I should stress that these are just the reported cases, and it's very clear that this overestimates the representation of teachers, clerics, and so on, and authority figures, because all the other evidence that we have suggests that the majority of child sexual abuse happens within the family, amongst you know, this category, family and acquaintance. But certainly in this data set of publicly acknowledged abuse, it's authority figures that are most strongly represented. Children in institutions, looked after children, were particularly vulnerable to abuse because they often were associated with the stigma of coming from the least respectable, the lowest socioeconomic strata. And you can see here that when we look at the locations of sexual abuse, that institutions are top the domestic location quite significantly there. Many of the children in children's homes, Borstal's approved schools and so on, swore they were familiar with the practices of drinking and promiscuity amongst adults. And that level of knowingness led to their categorisation by those looking after them as precocious adults, or as one children's home put it in the 1940s, as foul-minded. Children who were categorised in that fashion were often disbelieved if they did disclose sexual abuse, or despite being children, they were attributed with a degree of sexual agency that made it possible, made it seem possible for them to consent to sexual acts. And to give you a sense of this, I'll tell you about the case of Homer Lane. He was a teacher, a head teacher at a Home Office approved school founded during World War I. He was accused of sexual assault of his female charges in 1918, and an investigation was mounted. It's interesting for us because this is the first investigation into child sexual abuse allegations to be organised by the Home Office, and of course we're in the middle of another such investigation. During this investigation, another welfare worker wrote in his defence, "Such accusations are an occupational hazard. All rescue workers are accused of immorality, male or female, by the girls if there is a loophole." So you can see here a blanket refusal to credit the testimony of children in care. And Homer Lane himself was able to argue that the girls in his care were fantasists and convinced the management of the home that he was blameless. So there's a very complacent view about children's credibility, which led to frequent inaction on complaints. Though in this case, there is interestingly a resolution of sorts, because the Home Office investigation found that there was credible evidence that he was an abuser. Enough evidence for them to withdraw their grant, and the home was closed down. But they didn't make any recommendation as to what should happen to the children who were under the care of this particular school. And Homer Lane arranged to bring some of them into his household when he moved to London and set up as a private psychoanalyst. So the priority in this investigation was to avoid the sense that public funding might be associated with scandal. rather than any sense of protecting children from harm. It gives you an interesting sense of the lack of awareness of child safeguarding in this period. It's also worth bearing in mind that it wasn't necessary to come from a so-called rough working class background in order to be disbelieved. There's a very interesting example of this from the 1940s, when evacuation led to the billeting of 800,000 children with complete strangers. Presented in that context, you won't be surprised to learn that there was quite a significant number of cases of sexual abuse that resulted from evacuation. One evacuee reported to her teacher that she was being sexually abused by the male householder who had taken her in 1941. And initially, this is a very interesting case, she wasn't believed because of her history of what one of the welfare workers called slight nervous trouble. So it's clear that this is a good example of how really anything that could cast doubt on the credibility of children was used to deflect these disclosures. But in this case, when a moral welfare worker visited the home, who was aware that the girl came from what she called good parents and a comfortable home, the child was then believed and was moved to a new billet. So her class advantage essentially trumped the initial disbelief. Note again, there was no attempt to follow up with the police. There's no kind of criminal sanctions taken against the person accused of abuse. It's clear that the strategy of removal from harm is being preferred over the prosecution of child sexual abuse. We can also see some very interesting examples of a kind of untethering of institutional care from class privilege in relation to private schooling in Britain. So despite being sites of relative social privilege, British public schools proved to be tragically unable to prevent the development of a culture of child sexual abuse. These schools clearly are not attended by children who lack the cultural and social capital to make their voices heard, so they're very different from many of the children in our archive. Nonetheless, numbers of them still suffered from sexual abuse. Some of that may be partially explained by the problems I referred to earlier about boys testifying to abuse, but it's also clear that there was a real lack of any serious system of safeguarding in private schooling. They were much slower to root out teacher-led sexual abuse than much more heavily regulated state-funded schools. I should say both were really quite extraordinarily slow to institute a national system of cross-checking and blacklisting of teachers who had been accused or prosecuted of sexual abuse. You begin to see this being put in place in the 1944 Education Act. But still in the 1950s, it's not obligatory for schools to report allegations of sexual abuse to the police. And for the private sector, who are asked to participate in a voluntary blacklisting scheme, it's very clear that they had a strong motive to avoid scandal and preferred to simply quietly dismiss abusive teachers until well into the 1960s. And perhaps this partly explains why there are so many teachers featuring in our sample. It was the press who felt that they had a duty to report on these cases because they were aware of the lack of any other kind of blacklisting or safeguarding system. So clearly the relative freedom from state intervention that in effect parents who used that private educational sector were buying for their children was linked to greater vulnerability to abuse amongst those children. Now, let's turn now to the wider landscape of socioeconomic inequalities that influenced experiences of child sexual abuse. There's very clear research evidence that environments of income inequality and disadvantage are associated with the maltreatment of children in both physical and sexual terms. There's been a very interesting recent study of the United States over the period 2005-09, which identified the period of the financial crash and the kind of chaos that followed as showing very clear upticks in abuse of children. So there clearly are structural factors which intersect with societal attitudes in explaining the prevalence of child sexual abuse. And our data set, which represents a very small sample, offers us no opportunity to do any kind of statistically significant analysis. But it does give us the chance to think a bit about how these broader socioeconomic patterns might intersect with more specific circumstances of child sexual abuse. There's been a tendency to assume that poor living conditions, overcrowding, lack of facilities and so on, correlates with child sexual abuse, and that's certainly what the Victorians thought when they debated this question very extensively in the 1880s. So it's clear that children who lack basic goods are more likely to be cared for in chaotic ways, and particularly are likely to be vulnerable to child sexual exploitation and transactional sex. But it's also clear that child sexual abuse flourished in mid-20th century Britain under conditions of relative affluence, growing affluence, and full employment. We can only really estimate prevalence, but there's nothing in our sample to suggest that offending diminished in this period of increasing social equality. The post-war decades saw a transformation in the built environment, reducing overcrowding, giving families more adequate living space. That went with a much stronger emphasis on children's emotional and physical well-being, and went with a very specific expectation that children, and particularly adolescent children, might be offered their own bedrooms. Now, despite the intention there, which I think is to support the autonomy and privacy of children, this in fact made for greater vulnerability to children in the home to adult sexual advances. So paradoxically, those earlier conditions of overcrowding had in some ways reduced the chances of opportunistic sexual offending that relied on being able to physically isolate children. So a very interesting and counterintuitive effect there. The post-war decades also saw an increasing turn to Freudian ideas about the role of fantasy in children's unconscious lives. A 1963 pamphlet, which was called Child Victims of Sexual Offenders, for example, noted the most elaborate and circumstantial accusations sometimes made without any basis in fact. So around the 1960s, you see the emergence of a very extensive psychoanalytic infrastructure that lends credibility to this idea that children might imagine it all. So this is a profound intellectual change which makes for a very significant setbacks in relation to disclosure of child sexual abuse. There's also a sense amongst this Freudian-influenced psychoanalytic world that children might be actively promoting sexual activity with adults. And of course, this is the literature that then feeds into the paedophile rights movement in the 1970s and allows them briefly to have a certain credibility in saying that child-adult sexual relationships might not be harmful. So the author of that, the pamphlet that I cited earlier there, there's two authors, in fact, a criminologist and a psychiatrist. They believe that if children do disclose sexual abuse, and it does seem to be factually correct, that still shouldn't be understood necessarily as abuse. As they put it, many little girls know a great deal about sex behaviour from observation from an early age. It holds no great surprises. They may not participate emotionally in offences, but they certainly precipitate them. And if supported by another child of the same age, will blackmail adults to pay them weekly for the repetition of the same indecent act. So you see here, in fact, this is partly a kind of psychoanalytic sense that children are interested in sex, that they might solicit it. But also, I think there's a survival here of a much older sort of moral concern about prostitution and about the fact that these are blackmailing or actively economically motivated children seeking out sex. So even though we know that structural inequalities are correlated with rising levels of child sexual abuse, we also have to acknowledge the very specific historical context, which is influenced by these intellectual changes, by practitioner norms, by the built environment, which can make for a conjuncture where rising affluence can also be associated with greater vulnerability of children. Child sexual abuse occurs in very diverse socioeconomic contexts, and inequalities interact in a number of ways. It's sometimes the most underprivileged who emerges most vulnerable, but also privileges of class, of gender, and of income sometimes have paradoxical effects of increasing vulnerability to abuse. So it's been a consistent finding of our research, which spans seven decades, that quite small amounts of inequality in social authority could allow for disbelief of claims about sexual assault, precisely because such claims, such disclosures, such accusations are so socially tabooed and can rend the social fabric in such violent fashions, family and welfare practitioners are very reluctant to credit any kind of disclosures. They welcome any opportunities to postpone or refuse action, and that's where the very small inequalities in authority or power to make one's voice heard come into play. Child sexual abuse is a point where inequalities of age, of class, and of gender often intersected in complex ways and provided these conditions where disbelief was tragically easy to maintain. Thank you.